Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, where we bring you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. Today we're going to talk about the 9/11 Commission report. There was a lot of news going up to the 9/11 Commission report on the various hearings. You remember Richard Clark's testimony, Condoleezza Rice's testimony. At least you may remember some of it, but I think that the report brings a lot of it together. And what it does is dispels a lot of the myths that we've heard from the Bush administration and from their supporters regarding the president's awareness of what was going to happen on 9/11, the warnings of terrorism, and the Clinton administration. You note that they're always attacking the Clinton administration on 9/11, and a whole kind of variety of other things. For example, I think one of the most interesting things that comes clear in the report is not just that there was no collaborative relationship between September 11th and the war in Iraq. I think that that's pretty well known to most of us at this point. But we do find that there was a collaborative, operational relationship between al-Qaeda and Egypt. One of our greatest allies in the region, who we give billions of dollars to. Also, Saudi Arabia provided a fertile fundraising ground for Osama bin Laden. We've talked on the show about the fact that a lot of the money that went to Osama bin Laden came from Saudi Arabia. So they had a collaborative relationship. Again, a great ally, supporter of the Bush administration, a country that's helped George Bush bail him out many times with his companies. Oh, but not just Saudi Arabia. Algeria had a collaborative tie. Oh, and also Yemen. Yemen as well. And Lebanon. Lebanon had collaborative ties with al-Qaeda. Oh, and don't forget Morocco. And Tunisia. And Somalia. And Pakistan. In fact, it seems that about the only Arab country that did not have a collaborative relationship with al-Qaeda was Iraq. So for all the Republicans, next time you hear someone at the water cooler, right, someone at work say, oh, there was some tie between al-Qaeda and Iraq. One time there was an al-Qaeda guy in Iraq, they got medical help, or that they tried to work together, but of course they didn't like each other. We know that because Osama bin Laden didn't like that Saddam Hussein was a secular dictator. Saddam Hussein did not like that Osama bin Laden was an Islamist, someone who very much focused on religion. But Egypt didn't have any such compunction about working with Osama bin Laden. Neither did Algeria, Yemen, Lebanon, Morocco, Tunisia, Somalia, Saudi Arabia, and Pakistan. Well, according to the logic of the Bush administration, we should be invading all of those countries right now. None of those countries have a democracy. All of them mistreat their people. Do you know how badly the Egyptian secret police treats their people? Or Algeria, where they massacre tens of thousands? Or Yemen, the country that where the USS Cole was attacked? Or Lebanon, which is controlled entirely by Syria and uses Hezbollah to attack Israel? Even more moderate countries like Morocco and Tunisia were working with Osama bin Laden. So what this report tells us, and we're going to go through the report. I know that a lot of you haven't had a chance to read all of its 500-some pages. But we're going to go through the report and kind of give you the highlights, because it's very interesting what it has to say, and the details do matter. One of the things we found out here on the Inside Scoop is that people like, at least my listeners, like hearing the details. We're going to talk about the obsession with Iraq of this administration long before September 11th, after September 11th. We're going to talk about all the warnings that the Bush administration had about terrorism and did nothing about. We're going to talk about the things that Clinton did do something about. Actually, Clinton did a lot to try to stop the attacks. And we're also, of course, going to take your calls. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, toll-free 877-57-SCOOP. Or you can send an email to comment@radioinsidescoop.com. Or you can always contribute to the blog. Just go into www.radioinsidescoop.com, make your comment, and I'll read it on the air. I do, though, want to go through this report, because I think the media is giving sort of the spin. They're giving a few lines from it and not talking about the details. And I also want to talk about how to fix this. You know, the 9/11 Commission has some recommendations. And despite the fact that I think they do detail the problem pretty well, I'm not so sure about their recommendations. One of the recommendations is that the president have at cabinet level a national intelligence secretary, if you will, someone to control all of the intelligence. And, of course, that's a job now controlled by the CIA. And I'm a little worried about that. I'm a little worried about the fact that if you've got somebody that's chosen by the president, then maybe they're going to end up doing the same things that we've seen, basically developing a policy first and then developing the intelligence to back up that policy. I think you should have a person with a fixed term, much as we do the Federal Reserve Chairman, Alan Greenspan, appointed every 4 years in the middle of a presidential term, someone who's neutral, someone who can provide intelligence and distill and collect the information down that they're getting, but give like a good civil servant, a good bipartisan commission, if you will, someone that's just there to give the government the best information. You know, one of the complaints I've made about the Bush administration is with science, they fired all the scientists who used to be working in the government, places like the National Institute of Health and other scientific places. There used to be a number of scientists that would go and work and try to provide the best science available for the government. But the Bush administration decided they didn't want the best science available. Instead, they wanted certain political things. They wanted to argue that abortion causes breast cancer, even though it doesn't. They wanted to argue that teaching abstaining from sex somehow stops kids from having sex, which, of course, it doesn't. And so they fired all the reputable scientists and instead developed national commissions filled with their political appointees who would follow the politics first and the science second. Well, my concern is that intelligence is going to get the same treatment under the proposals of the 9/11 Commission, that if the 9/11 Commission goes and simply has a political appointee in that job, then we're going to have the same problem we've had before. We have the CIA doing political advocacy and not just gathering intelligence. So there's a lot to talk about. There's the recommendations. There's the Homeland Security Department. There's the off-the-shelf Homeland Security Department created by George Bush called TTIC, the Terrorist Threat Information Center. If you haven't heard about it, there's a reason for that. And really talk about why it is that the administration didn't care about terrorism before 9/11, didn't focus on it. But as always, I want to hear from you, whether it's comments on Bush's success or failure in the war on terrorism, in Clinton's success or failure, or in how John Kerry plans to fix the situation. I want to hear from you. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, toll-free, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can send an email to comment at radioinsidescoop.com. When we come back, we're going to start taking the report piece by piece, go through the report, talk about what Bush knew before 9/11, what the people in his government knew or should have known before 9/11, and what they did or didn't do. How it is that they confronted the repeated threats before 9/11. We'll talk about Clinton and how he confronted the threats, and then we'll talk about what do we do now. What do we do after 9/11 to fix the situation? So, again, feel free to call in 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop right after this.
Bush and gang came into office claiming to be morally superior to the sexually crass Bill Clinton. They took special glee in highlighting Clinton's reprehensible attempts to parse the legal language of what constitutes sex, pointing to Bill's infamous contortions over what the definition of is. But, holy hypocrite, look who's doing legalistic contortions now, parsing the language of the law not to excuse personal sexual misconduct, but to rationalize the much more crass act of official torture. Internal memos now show that all of Bush's top lawyers were straining at the bit to unleash the CIA, FBI, and military forces to break both U.S. and international laws that ban the use of torture when interrogating prisoners of war. One in particular, a 2002 memo by Jay Bybee, top legal counsel in Bush's Justice Department, went to extremes to claim that in grilling detainees, the Bushites could use practically any torture methods short of killing prisoners without violating either our own nation's torture law or the Geneva Accords. Bybee's memo went into excruciating detail to parse such terms as severe pain, imminent death, and profound mental disruption. The memo concludes that only physical pain as intense as you would expect from organ failure or death qualifies as torture. Short of that, anything goes. The same anything-goes mentality that corrupted Enron and most of corporate America now is loose at the highest levels of government. It just shows that if top officials unleash crafty lawyers to justify the most despicable actions, they will. By the way, George W. has subsequently put Bybee on the U.S. Court of Appeals, where he can apply his anything-goes mentality to all the cases that come before him. This is Jim Hightower saying, we need a president who will choose lawyers of conscience, not of convenience.
38%.
46%.
42%.
I cut my payments in half.
How much can you cut your monthly student loan payments by refinancing with College Loan Corporation? To find out, just call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will answer your questions and tell you how you can cut your monthly payment by up to 50% by refinancing your federal student loans at rates as low as 2.63%. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
Your dog eats your new sofa. Pet satisfaction rating 3%. Your hairdresser doesn't know burnt auburn from burnt toast. Hair color satisfaction rating 5%. After years of marriage, your husband still leaves the seat up. Spouse satisfaction rating minus 2%. Your car insurance company saves you hundreds of dollars and handles your claim quickly and fairly. Car insurance satisfaction rating 97%. Oh, you must have Geico.
Geico's customer satisfaction stands at 97%. How would you rate your car insurance company? Geico. 1-800-947-AUTO.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We're talking about the 9/11 Commission report, and we're taking your calls. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, toll-free 877-57-SCOOP. Or you can send an email to comment@radioinsidescoop.com. I want to start with a comment that I received from Fred in New York City. Fred writes, Mark, I'm having a hard time taking the 9/11 report too seriously. I'm currently working my way through the report, and I still haven't seen anything about how these attacks were funded. There's no real mention of the Saudi connection to the attacks or the administration flying Saudis out of the country. There's nothing that tells us what Prince Bandar bin Sultan and Bush spoke about when they met after 9/11. Fred goes on, but let me respond. Fred, to some extent, I agree with you. I think that they do give the Saudis a bit of a pass. Now, the 9/11 report does talk about the substantial funding that Saudi Arabia has given to al-Qaeda. They claim that it's not necessarily with the royal family's approval, that it was given to charities that then the money found its way to al-Qaeda. And then talks about how Saudi Arabia was fertile financing ground. But you got to remember, the Saudi Arabians didn't really cooperate with the 9/11 Commission that much. And the other thing that I'd like to know is the 28 pages of the Senate Intelligence Committee report on 9/11 prior to the Commission. You see, there was less than half a page on Iraq. There's very little because they can't find anything on Iraq. We'll talk about that in a minute. But there were 28 pages on Saudi ties to Osama bin Laden. And according to Senator Graham of Florida, these are pages that should have been released to the public. He felt that no more than 5% of it had to be blacked out to protect sources and methods, but the other 95% would show the extensive Saudi ties to Osama bin Laden. The State Department, the Pentagon, the Defense Department, none of them wanted to release that information on the connection with the Saudis. So I have to wonder if they put the same brakes on the 9/11 Commission. Remember, not everything the 9/11 Commission reported is in their report, and I'd be willing to bet that there's a lot of Saudi influence there, much, much more than we've heard about. So I have to agree with you there. One thing, though, that it does mention, and this, by the way, is a direct quote from the report. I'll read it to you. It says on page 67, al-Qaeda continued to collaborate closely with the many Middle Eastern groups in Egypt, Algeria, Yemen, Lebanon, Morocco, Tunisia, Somalia, and elsewhere, with which it had been linked when bin Laden was in Sudan. So it's clear that they do have a wide variety of support within the Arab world, as it happens about the only place there doesn't seem to be ties, in collaborative ties, is in Iraq. Note that it uses the word collaborate to talk about the other countries. It also goes on to say, this is again a quote from the 9/11 report, al-Qaeda also reinforced its London base and its other offices around Europe, the Balkans, and the Caucasus. Bin Laden bolstered his links to extremists in South and Southeast Asia, including the Malaysian-Indonesian JI, and several Pakistani groups engaged in the Kashmir conflict. So they were all over the world. They were even in London. And I haven't heard that the administration wants to bomb the Thames River in London quite yet, but they clearly had ties there. I want to read on from Fred's comment, though, and respond a little bit more. Fred says, I sat through nearly every minute of the televised portions of the 9/11 Commission on C-SPAN, and they asked a lot more softball questions than I would have in their place. Well, I think, Fred, that some of them did. Some of the commissioners, like Governor Thompson, Republican, really seemed to have his goal to try to... He's a Republican, and he very much played a partisan role, tried to very much discredit Richard Clark, tried to help the Bush administration in any way he can. I don't know that you could say it can be true about others. I think Richard Benveniste asked some tough questions. Jamie Gorelick did. Former Senator Kerry of Nebraska did. So some of them did, some of them didn't. Fred goes on to say, what I did learn from all that time is that while we feel differently today than before 9/11, the world didn't change. It was the same dangerous role we find ourselves in today. What we had going for us prior to 9/11 were tireless watchdogs like Richard Clark. When something happened in the Clinton administration, it was monitored and stopped, and we didn't have to scare anyone by raising a color-coded alert on the evening news. In fact, I didn't know how good a job Clinton was doing until we started picking the record apart. Well, and I want to talk about that, Fred. In fact, throughout this hour, I want to talk about the specific things that Clinton did without raising the color-coded alert, and talk about the color-coded alert, in fact, that was just came in last night. Last night, yesterday, I was inclined to believe the administration. In fact, I even said that on my show, and I still do believe there's a real threat, and there's a real threat to these buildings. But again, the timing, I'm beginning to think is suspect. I reported on this program a few weeks ago. The report first had in the New Republic magazine that documented a number of Pakistani officials talking about the Bush administration pressing them to get some big al-Qaeda operative before the election and preferably during the first 3 days of the Democratic National Convention in Boston. And then we know on the fourth day, the day of Kerry's speech, they reported capture of this al-Qaeda operative in Pakistan. What we found out today, though, was that the operative was captured many days earlier, at least a week, if not earlier, before the day of the announcement, which was the day of John Kerry's acceptance speech of the nomination. And now we find, it was reported in today's Washington Post, that the color-coded alert, the orange-coded alert, came from information from this al-Qaeda operative. So, in other words, there is a connection between at least the timing of the announcement and John Kerry's acceptance speech. Now, I was willing to think this didn't occur. And, you know, the irony is that I keep thinking, well, okay, I won't trust the Bush administration here. I won't trust them here. But surely they're not going to give a specific warning on specific targets and use it to scare Americans right after the Democratic convention to prevent a John Kerry bounce in the polls. Well, I'm afraid that even I trusted the Bush administration a little too much, because we now know that this report came from the al-Qaeda operative that, as I said, was captured far earlier and whose capture was only announced the day of John Kerry's acceptance speech, as I and the New Republic predicted a month ago. So you got to ask yourself, what else is in this prediction? What else is going to come? Are they going to capture Osama bin Laden prior to October? Well, let's read from the Pakistani sources in their intelligence. Here's what they have to say. One of them says, the Pakistani government is really desperate and wants to flush out bin Laden and his associates after the latest pressures from the U.S. administration to deliver before the upcoming U.S. elections. Here's what another one said. No timetables were discussed in 2002 and 2003, but the November election is bringing a new deadline pressure to the hunt. Another official, this one from the Pakistani Interior Ministry, which is responsible for internal security, says, the Musharraf government has a history of rescuing the Bush administration. They, meaning the Bush administration, now wants Musharraf to bail them out when they are facing hard times in the coming elections. Source after source after source. Here's another source. This is an official who works under the director of the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Organization. They said that the Pakistanis, quote, have been told at every level that apprehension or killing of high-value targets, meaning al-Qaeda operatives, before the elections is an absolute must. Here's what the same guy said. The last 10 days of July deadline has been given repeatedly by visitors to Islamabad, the Pakistani capital, and in meetings in Washington between the Bush administration and Lieutenant General Ehsan-ul-Haq, the director of Pakistani intelligence. According to this official, a White House aide told Ul-Haq last spring, quote, it would be best if the arrest or killing of high-value targets were announced on 26, 27, or 28 July, unquote. Those, of course, are the first 3 days of the Democratic National Convention in Boston. Now, you have to understand what the Bush administration is giving Pakistan for this. They're giving Pakistan, in fact, Colin Powell designated Pakistan a major non-NATO ally, which allows its military to purchase a whole wide array of U.S. weaponry. Even more important, our government has refused to criticize Musharraf, the head of Pakistan, for pardoning the nuclear physicist A.Q. Khan, the guy that sold nuclear secrets to Iran, to North Korea, and to Libya. And in fact, the administration is now pushing a $3 billion aid package to Pakistan, even though there are obviously concerns about Pakistan's proliferation of nuclear technology and the lack of a democratic reform. As one Pakistani general said, if we don't find these guys by the election, they're going to stick this whole nuclear mess up our rear end. He used a more colloquial phrase. The point is this. We have really been pressing Pakistan. That's clear. And the fact that this operative was captured the day of John Kerry's election, his nomination, I should say, it's really hard to say it's a coincidence when we had all this information a month beforehand. Now, I have listeners, conservatives, who say, Mark, you know, you're into all these conspiracy theories. Well, how is it then that I predicted this? And I don't, not just me. I mean, you have the New Republic, a very respected magazine. You have these specific people in Pakistani intelligence. How is it that we predicted this? So I guess that, Fred, I would respond to you by saying that this administration obviously should be concerned about al-Qaeda. In fact, I've long argued for more than a year since I've been doing this radio show that al-Qaeda is our primary target. It should be. They killed 3,000 Americans. They murdered them. And in fact, we shouldn't have been taking troops from Afghanistan, leaving it to be the anarchy that it's becoming. We've done shows on that. And putting them in Iraq where they weren't necessary. So I've been arguing this for some time. So obviously I support the Bush administration going after these high-value targets. But it's the timing that's suspect. Why is it important to do it on the day that Kerry accepts his nomination speech? Why is it important to announce what we now know, that we had this guy captured at least a week earlier, maybe even earlier than that, and to announce the targets that we knew about again a week earlier? Why is it important to announce them now? Yesterday, before I knew we had these targets earlier, I was still willing to give the Bush administration the benefit of the doubt. Well, now don't I feel stupid, because I guess I'm not willing to do that anymore. But as we go through the report, again, I want to go through what the Clinton administration did, what the Bush administration did, and let me just finish reading Fred's email. Fred said, we can make changes to our intelligence infrastructure, but we need to first be honest with ourselves. Systemic failures aren't at the core of 9/11. Certainly it was a problem, but negligence at the top is the culprit. We need a real assessment of what happened, who really was asleep at the switch, who our enemies really are, before we can expect any real change, and why don't we put Richard Clark back on the job? Well, Fred, I agree Richard Clark should be back on the job. And I think your point about systemic failures is very important. The 9/11 Commission, remember, did a unanimous report, and there are 5 Democrats and 5 Republicans, and their focus obviously was not on who to blame, not on swinging the election. Their focus was how to make changes for the future. But in not focusing the blame, I think you're right, Fred, they're not focusing enough on the failures of the people in charge. We had people at the 9/11 Commission, the chairman, say that basically the system failed and good people can work around a bad system, but they shouldn't have to. We should change the system. But I'd like to read to you what William Odom, the director of the National Security Agency under Ronald Reagan, had to say in this regard. He said that effective leaders do not tolerate inadequate intelligence performance or leave it to commissions to fix intelligence problems. And in fact, he gave a specific case study about what happened in late World War II. In 1944, there were 4 generals that were fighting the German army, and Montgomery, Bradley, Eisenhower, and Patton. And what we found is that Montgomery... There was some intelligence to suggest that the Germans were going to attack in the last great battle, the Battle of the Bulge of World War II. And Montgomery and his intelligence officer, they rejected the information. The intelligence officer rejected it just like Montgomery. Bradley, and his intelligence officer was skeptical and passive. Eisenhower and his intelligence officer were somewhat quicker to sense the danger, but slower than Patton. Patton, again, the same intelligence officer seeing the same information, Patton got his divisions ready to meet the offensive. And in writing up this case study, again, this is Odom speaking, but he's talking about a case study by Harold Deutsch, a military historian in World War II. What he showed is that the commanders, the personalities of the commanders, intimidated their intelligence officers. It's very interesting. The intelligence was the same among the four intelligence officers of these four great generals. But the certain commanders intimidated their intelligence officers, discouraged them from emphasizing unpleasant findings or pursuing, you know, other lines of analyses to examine it further. And this is Harold Deutsch's words, quote, "Whether the commanding general was on the correct or wrong track made the intelligence officer more likely to be right there with him. Perhaps the finest performance of Patton's intelligence officer, Gustav Koch, was largely due to being lucky with his boss," unquote. And I think this is a very interesting study. It comes from World War II. We can't argue about, you know, partisan anything one way or the other. But it shows that under the right leadership, bosses make their employees work better. I think most of us know this, frankly, in the business world. You know there are bosses that encourage free thinking, that encourage you to challenge them. I've had bosses, working as a lawyer, I've had some terrific bosses who would tell me something and I would come back and I would say, well, you know what? We could do it the way you said, but what about this? What about this? What about this? And I've had good bosses that said to me, well, Mark, I agree with you there. Let's change that. I don't agree with you there, and let me tell you why, and so forth. And that's the collaborative relationship. Two minds really are better than one. In fact, I would argue two minds are better than two. There's the two minds, and there's the third mind of all working together. I've had other bosses that are just the opposite. You probably know what I mean. I remember working as a lawyer and given an assignment, and I came back and I said, well, here's the assignment, but why don't we look at this question? Why don't we look at this question? And I've had the same, a different boss from a different law firm, I should say, Mark, I didn't ask you about XYZ. I asked you about W. I'm not paying you to do XYZ. You do W. Forget XYZ. Well, when they did that, obviously, they never found the interesting things in XYZ that related to W. Again, I think we all know this intuitively from business. And yet this is exactly the point that National Security Agency Director under Ronald Reagan, William Odom, is making, and the same point that Fred, in fact, made from New York City. I think it's a great point that leaders do control the intelligence. Sometimes it's directly. We know that Dick Cheney went to the bowels of the CIA and tried very much to push young associates to find the intelligence he wanted. But sometimes it's indirectly. Sometimes it's just an atmosphere. Sometimes it's just the president telling Richard Clark 3, 4, 5 times, you go find a connection between Al-Qaeda and Iraq. And when Richard Clark says, Mr. President, there is no connection, he says, go look again. Well, what are you telling someone when you say go look again? The Republicans will say you're not lying. They're just saying to look. But when you tell someone who doesn't find a connection, go look again 2, 3 times, then maybe you're just trying to influence intelligence. So when we come back, I want to talk about the specifics of what the Bush administration did or didn't do about intelligence, what the Clinton administration did or didn't do, and how do we fix all this? How do we create a system that both solves the intelligence problems and deals with faulty leadership? If you have a comment, all you have to do is call in 877-57-SCOOP, toll free, 877-577-2667, or you can send an email to comment@radioinsidescoop.com. We'll be right back after this.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner. California builders and contractors aren't too happy with Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's decision to allocate $3.8 million of the state's new budget to a labor studies institute at the University of California. The Institute for Labor and Employment was started by former Governor Gray Davis to provide policymakers with information regarding trends in the state's labor force, such as the value of city living wage laws. The Golden Gate chapter of the Associated Builders and Contractors of California was hopeful Schwarzenegger would follow through with his campaign promise to kill the institute. But pressure from the California Labor Federation forced the governor to maintain funding.
On Friday, the U.S. agreed to make a 20% cut in some of the $19 billion in subsidies paid to American farmers each year. The agreement came during the around-the-clock talks with other members of the World Trade Organization. The cuts include subsidies for corn, cotton, rice, wheat, and soybeans. Some West African countries have claimed that American cotton subsidies have had a devastating effect on thousands of farmers in their countries. The trade talks imploded in 2001 when the U.S. and European Union refused to address the subsidy concerns of poorer nations.
A union of East Coast grocery workers meets with a federal mediator today to try to hash out a labor agreement with grocery giant Shaw's Supermarkets. If a deal can't be reached for the 39 union stores in southeastern Massachusetts and Rhode Island, about 6,000 employees are set to strike this week. Shaw says it won't budge from its final offer, which includes a 27% cut in benefits and raises insurance copays without increasing wages.
Workers in Athens are still threatening to strike during the Olympics. Hotel workers, drivers, and paramedics have been warning the government about the impending strike for more than 2 months. They are demanding bonuses for the increased stress they will endure during the Games. The problem? No money. The budget for the Games has already spiraled above the proposed budget. The hotel strike is set to begin next Thursday. The right to strike is a valued democratic right in Greece, and the government is concerned about the potential fallout if an emergency decree is issued making walkouts illegal.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Pirates don't just exist in movies. According to a report released by the British Maritime Bureau, pirates have killed more people in the first 6 months of this year than during the same period any other year in the past decade. 30 people have been killed so far in 2004 compared to 16 last year. The most dangerous waters are off the coast of Nigeria, followed by Indonesia, Vietnam, Bangladesh, and the Philippines. You've been listening to WIND, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Welcome back to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington. We're talking about the 9/11 Commission Report. And as usual here on the Inside Scoop, we don't just give you the sound bites. We give you the details of the report, and we take your calls. Lines are open. It's 877-57-SCOOP, toll-free 877-577-2667, or you can send an email to comment at radioinsidescoop.com. The other thing you can do, and a lot of people are doing, is they're commenting on the blog, and I want to read a lot of those comments. It's very easy to comment on the blog. Just go to www.radioinsidescoop.com. Say whatever you want. You can go under a pseudonym if you like. And in fact, this comment is from John Q. Public. John Q. Public writes, "I think our intelligence should be structured so that our president has some." Rick actually says something similar, where he says, "George Bush, intelligence? Isn't that an oxymoron?" But in a more serious comment, Rick says, and I think this is a very important point, this is a direct quote, "I think that whatever Bush will do regarding the 9/11 report, it'll be just like his other lofty goals, like AIDS prevention funding, like No Child Left Behind, Homeland Security, make a big blustery speech and then not actually fund the program. That way the public thinks he's doing something, but look deeper and Bush's programs are just skin deep." I think that's a great point, Rick, and I think it's exactly how Washington works, particularly this president. With No Child Left Behind, he talked about this huge funding to help kids and, of course, didn't fund his own program. Same is true with AIDS prevention in Africa. It came a big speech in his State of the Union, then didn't fund the program. Instead, the programs he has funded are the tax cuts for the extremely wealthy people, people who make millions. And in fact, as we know, as we've talked about in this program, if you inherit more than $100 million, George Bush doesn't think you should have to pay taxes. Because people who inherit $150, $200, $500 million, people who inherit $1 billion, those are far more worthy American citizens than someone working hard at the minimum wage trying to feed their family. So those things he funds. But Homeland Security, 9/11 Commission, I think you're right. He'll make a big blustery speech and not fund them. And that's why I wish the press would follow up and watch these things. I think it's a very good point, Rick. We got another, I think, very good comment by James. James writes, "The most suspect timing," meaning the timing of these reports that there's a terrorist attack, "was on the day that Kerry announced Edward as his running mate. On that very day, Tom Ridge had a press conference and announced a non-specific threat, a threat that was so general that the terror level was never even raised. This administration is obviously trying to use fear as a campaign tool. James, I agree with you. In fact, that threat was, you're right, it was non-specific. The threat level wasn't raised, and that one clearly was political. I was hoping that the newest one, given it gave specific buildings, the IMF, the World Bank in Washington, certain financial centers in New York and New Jersey, I was hoping that this one was real. And I guess I still believe that the most recent terror threat is a real threat, but I think the timing is suspect. If they had this threat 8 days ago, why didn't they announce it 8 days ago? If they had it 2 weeks ago, why not announce it 2 weeks ago? Why announce it just after the convention to try to prevent a Kerry bounce? Rick also writes, I think it would be a good idea to have a nonpartisan committee to liaison between all our intelligence agencies and the FBI. Maybe a group made up from people from the agencies that are given a clear and exact directive. This has been my point all along, Rick, and actually it differs from the 9/11 Commission, and to that extent differs with John Kerry. I'm not John Kerry's mouthpiece. I don't agree with everything he says. He talked about, you know, implementing all the 9/11 Commission report. In this case, I think the one thing I don't agree with is this idea that you have a commission appointed by the president serving at his leisure. I think that one thing, by the way, I do agree with the 9/11 Commission report on, and this is very important, is that intelligence should be about intelligence. Intelligence shouldn't be about policy. They shouldn't be advocating a specific thing. They shouldn't care one way or the other whether we go into Iraq or even Afghanistan, for that matter. Intelligence should give the president and Congress intelligence. They should go through all the information that we glean by our satellites, that we glean by our spies, put it together, distill it as best they can. If there's contradictory intelligence, give those contradictions to the policymakers. Say, well, there's one guy that we tortured that says there's a connection between Al-Qaeda and Iraq, but no one else says it, and the guy, since we stopped the torture, recanted the information, instead of what actually happened, where the one guy that we tortured's information was used by everybody, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, Don Rumsfeld, and so forth. Give the information to the policy officials. And the policy officials, I would hope, if there were a decent leader, would look at the information and then decide how to act, instead of deciding how to act first and then reading the information later. That, excuse me, is very much backwards. But that, of course, is what the administration has done. So I agree with the 9/11 report that we need to have intelligence agencies distill the information, present it to the president. After all, we know, for example, the State Department got the information right. They knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. They knew about the lie, the forgery in Niger, where the president said that Saddam Hussein was trying to get nuclear weapons from Africa. The State Department reported that was false. So we definitely need to separate policy from intelligence. The part where I disagree with the 9/11 Commission is where they say that basically this is someone who serves at the president's leisure. I don't like that. I don't like that kind of control. We know, for example, that CIA Director George Tenet bent over backwards to please George Bush and Bill Clinton, for that matter, telling them what they want to hear, basically not telling them bad news, such as the Sudan pharmaceutical plant may not have been making chemical weapons in Clinton's case, or in Bush's case that there was no connection between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. If you've got a guy who thinks that he should give good news instead of being, you know, loyal to the truth, this is what happens. I think it'd be more likely to have an independent branch, one more loyal to the truth, more like the Federal Reserve Board. I don't know if you know enough about the Federal Reserve Board. It's sort of unclear to a lot of Americans. It's run by Alan Greenspan. The chairman is chosen by the president every 4 years, but not at the beginning of the president's term. He's chosen, or she, if there ever is a female Fed director, is chosen 2 years into the term so that his or her four-year term overlaps the presidential terms. And that makes the Fed more independent. The other people on the Fed board are the bankers, the national bankers from various regions across the nation. And again, they're chosen based on skill, not based on partisan ties. In fact, most of them have 14-year terms, quite a long term. And this insulates the Fed somewhat from political pressure. Not completely. I think the Federal Reserve Board still has incentives to try to lower interest rates right before elections and so forth, but I think it's far more insulated than, say, the CIA has been. I'd like to use the Fed as a model, and I haven't quite seen this reported anywhere else. This is my idea. But to use the Federal Reserve as a model to make sure that the first goal of intelligence agencies is to truth, getting the best evidence out there. And if the evidence is contradictory, one source who we tortured says one thing, one source who we didn't torture says something else, bring it all in, give in all the factors. I'm not advocating torture, but if we did, do it. Announce that his comments were made under torture, and let the administration know what's going on, and then let them decide. And it's not just the administration. We need better congressional oversight. We know, for example, that the senators that voted to allow George Bush authority to go to war in Iraq, including John Kerry and John Edwards, we know that they didn't have the same administration, the same information that the Bush administration had. The Bush administration had daily briefings by the CIA. The senators didn't have any of this. So I would like to see a intelligence agency or central intelligence. You'd think the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, would be that. But to see a set-up branch of government that's controlled under Congress as well, where they can be called at any time before the Senate Intelligence Committee, the House Intelligence Committee, meeting in secret if they have to, and that they should be able to subpoena any bit of information. Seems to me that congressional oversight is every bit as important as oversight by the President of the United States. How is it that we have information that the President has that the Senate and House don't have? That I have a real problem with. That needs to be fixed. I do want to talk, though, and I said I would, about the Bush administration, the Clinton administration's preparedness for 9/11. And I think for all the attacks on Bill Clinton, it's important to see how the report praised him. The report said that President Clinton was deeply concerned about Osama bin Laden. He and his national security advisor, Samuel Berger, ensured they had a special daily pipeline of reports feeding in the latest updates on bin Laden's reported terrorism. And even though in public Clinton spoke little about bin Laden and nothing about al-Qaeda, in private he was very much pressing them, very much focusing on the Millennium threat. And we know, of course, that later on, Sandy Berger requested only one personal meeting with Condoleezza Rice, and that was specifically to talk about bin Laden. In fact, Clinton established something called the Bin Laden Unit in 1996, way back, to focus on bin Laden and to weaken him while he was still living in Sudan. And in fact, the report mentions that al-Qaeda was severely weakened by Clinton's actions in Sudan. The report says that President Clinton made chemical, biological, and nuclear terrorism its very highest priority. Its very highest priority. Now look how we have nuclear proliferation in Iran, North Korea. Bush doesn't seem to care, right? Weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, a few biological weapons were enough to go in, but in Iran and North Korea, we don't care. Not true with President Clinton. President Clinton made the highest priority, it's again the very highest priority, according to the words 9/11 report, chemical, biological, nuclear weapons, and also devoted considerable time to seeking cooperation from other nations to deny sanctuary to terrorists. Again, it shows the benefit of international cooperation. He proposed larger budgets for the FBI, the increase, most of it was specifically designated for counterterrorism, and in the CIA, he supported, again, higher counterterrorism supplemental funding. We know that in the last weeks of December 1999, approaching the millennium, Clinton was on high alert to try to stop that attack. We know that Clinton arrested a large number of al-Qaeda members. And Richard Clark actually in 1998 had a scenario in one of his exercises about what could happen about where a group flew a plane for a suicide mission in Washington. So the Clinton administration was pretty much on the ball, despite all the things you hear to contrary by Republican operatives. When we come back, I want to talk about the Bush administration not being so much on the ball as the Clinton administration, why that's so, and could have anything to do with the focus on Iraq. If you want to call in and comment on any of this, agree or disagree, I always welcome your calls. The lines are open. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP. 877-57-SCOOP, or you can send an email to comment@radioinsidescoop.com. We'll be right back.
time for another Gooberhead Award. Presented periodically to those in the news who have their tongues going 100 miles per hour, but who forgot to put their brains in gear. Today, I've got a whole nest of goobers for you, all of whom are nesting in the fraud-ridden Pentagon. Except when they fly that coop to feather their nest with top jobs at Lockheed, Boeing, Halliburton, and other corporations that pocket billions in bloated Pentagon contracts. The scam of such goobers is to work a while at the Pentagon, gain insider knowledge and contacts, then peddle their insider connections to corporations wanting more fat contracts from us taxpayers. Take Pete Aldridge, who has made a career of spinning in and out of the revolving door between the Pentagon and military contractors. He was Secretary of the Air Force, then, whoosh, whoosh, he left to become President of Air Force contractor McDonnell Douglas. Then, whoosh, whoosh, George W. brought him back inside to be in charge of all Pentagon purchases. Last year, whoosh, whoosh, he left again, this time to become a highly paid board member at Lockheed. But just before leaving, he personally approved a $3 billion contract for 20 jet fighters to be made by, you guessed it, Lockheed. Even while Pete's on Lockheed's payroll, Bush named him chairman of a space exploration commission. Pete's commission recently called for privatizing NASA. Guess what corporation stands to gain the most from such a move? Bingo, if you said Lockheed. About his glaring conflicts of interest, Pete simply declares that he's in compliance with current ethics laws. But of course, these laws are shams, written by lobbyists for goobers like Pete. Legal isn't the same as moral. This is Jim Hightower saying, to learn more about this nest of goobers, call the Project on Government Oversight, 202-347-1122.
Hi, this is Doug Dupuy for SelectQuote, and I just called...
Cheryl Payne.
One of SelectQuote's licensed agents.
Hi, Mr. Dupuy.
Hi, Cheryl. Why buy term life insurance through SelectQuote instead of somebody else?
Well, Mr. Dupuy, about 2 out of 3 people have health or lifestyle issues. Could be high blood pressure, skydiving. Now, depending on what insurance company you choose, you could overpay hundreds of dollars a year.
Well, where does SelectQuote come in?
SelectQuote's a real matchmaker. We impartially shop the pick of America's top life insurers to match you with your best buy.
Got an example?
Sure. I just matched a man 40 years old who takes cholesterol medication with a $500,000 policy for under $22 a month.
Quite a match, Cheryl. Why not let SelectQuote match you with your best buy? Just call 1-800-772-8300. That's 1-800-772-8300. Or log on to SelectQuote.com.
Example is First Colony Preferred Best Colony 10-year term policy form 1420 and 1421 et al. Underwritten by First Colony Life Insurance Company, a GE Financial Assurance Company, Lynchburg, Virginia. Policy subject to underwriting approval, available in most states.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We can take your calls if you want in the last 10 minutes we got here, 877-57-SCOOP. We're not getting many calls, and I think that may be because you just want to hear details of the report. And I'm happy to comply. That's part of what we do here on the Inside Scoop. We give you the details you need, and we don't just give you the spin. And in fact, some of the details are coming from you folks. Brian from New Jersey writes, Cheney, Vice President Cheney, was in charge of the terrorism task force and never met once, but met several times with his energy commission. That's proof enough the Bush administration couldn't care less. That's a great point, of course, Brian. Very few people even realize that Dick Cheney was head of the commission to deal with terrorism. And how many times did they meet? Brian's absolutely right. They didn't meet a single time. His energy commission, the one that he doesn't want to talk about, the one that Supreme Court may or may not make him disclose information about, he's fighting it very hard, that met several times. But it wasn't just Vice President Cheney, right? We know, for example, that Richard Clark really pressed Condoleezza Rice hard to have a principals meeting, a cabinet-level meeting on the Al-Qaeda network. He wrote, "We urgently need..." Okay, urgently, by the way, with underlined and italics. We urgently need a principals-level review on the Al-Qaeda network. And, of course, we know that there was no such review until September 4th, 2001. They talked about Al-Qaeda briefly before going on to other subjects such as Russia and the Persian Gulf and the Middle East peace process. So Now, maybe, well, George Bush had his vacation. He had the longest vacation in presidential history. He's busy on the golf course. Maybe he didn't have time for principals meetings. They had one on Iraq before this time, before September. They had one on Sudan. So they had other principals meetings on other countries. Again, Iraq was always a focus of the Bush administration. Why is it that before 9/11, Iraq was so much more important to the administration than al-Qaeda, despite the urgent memos of Richard Clark, despite the specific memo, in fact, he wrote in December 2000, just as the Clinton administration was drawing to a close, the famous Blue Sky memo, proposing how to attack al-Qaeda. Well, Richard Clark argued the White House should aid the Northern Alliance, the Afghani group trying to attack al-Qaeda, and according to Condoleezza Rice, George Bush said he didn't want to do that. He was tired of, quote, swatting at flies, unquote. To which Senator Kerry of Nebraska said, well, with all due respect, Ms. Rice, what flies did the administration swat at? At least the Clinton administration, swatting at flies, used cruise missiles, killed a number of al-Qaeda operatives, and barely missed Osama bin Laden. Bush decided basically there were no flies to swat at all. Remember, the USS Cole bombing occurred right before Clinton left office, right in October of 2000. And Bill Clinton decided, again, rightly or wrongly, to trust the Bush administration to let them decide how to respond because he didn't want to do to them what George Bush Sr. did to Clinton in Somalia, that is, begin a policy and then leave it to the new president to deal with it. And what's interesting is that neither Donald Rumsfeld nor Wolfowitz nor apparently Bush or Cheney felt that we should respond to the USS Cole. This is the president arguing that we should be toughest on terrorism. Why didn't we respond to the Cole? It's not just them, of course. You have Attorney General John Ashcroft, for example, ignoring specific warnings about an upcoming attack. And he didn't want to focus on terrorism. John Ashcroft was focused much more on missile defense, we know. In fact, I remember the day of 9/11. I've reported this often, though I haven't seen it much elsewhere. I remember sitting on Capitol Hill about to attend a hearing by the Democrats on how it is that we should not spend so much money on missile defense. We need to take that same money and spend it on counterterrorism. The administration was fighting it terribly. They didn't want to spend money on counterterrorism. And what we have from the 9/11 report was we have the FBI saying specifically that Attorney General did not want to build up capabilities to combat terrorism. In fact, FBI Director Pickard says that Ashcroft said he doesn't want to hear about it anymore. He'd heard so many briefings about terrorism, he was sick of it. Did not want to hear about the threats anymore. And on September 10th, the Attorney General, John Ashcroft, specifically denied, in writing, an appeal by FBI Acting Director Pickard for more money to go to counterterrorism. So Ashcroft, who was, by the way, flying in special planes, he was not flying commercial jets. He had heard about the possible attacks on commercial jets. He'd heard about a threat. He decided he didn't want to fly regular planes. Still, he wasn't focused on terrorism. And he couldn't recall a lot of it. It's what the commission report said. So what is it about the administration that they didn't want to focus on it? I mean, did they have enough information? Bush says if we had known, certainly we would have done something about it. Well, let's talk about the evidence that they had, because this is supposed to be all about intelligence failures. Let's talk about the intelligence successes. We've talked on this show about the specific information in Arabic that came on September 10th, warning about the big attack on September 11th, that was not translated until September 12th. Of course, we've had a big shortage of Arabic translators. You've heard about some of this with Sibel Edmonds. Part of it is because we fired some of our best translators because they're gay. It may be strange, but in fact, the administration's homophobia actually has harmed national policy, national intelligence. But it's more than that Arabic memo. There's Clark's, that Arabic intercepts, I should say. There's Clark's information to Condoleezza Rice that, quote, he thought there were terrorist cells within the United States, including al-Qaeda. How many intelligence reports did President Bush get that related to bin Laden from his day in office till September 10, 2001? Answer, more than 40. It wasn't just the presidential daily brief entitled Bin Laden Determined to Strike in the United States. He received more than 40 intelligence articles. Now, whether he read them or not, I don't know. I do know that Some of them are include. Here's one titled, Bin Laden Threats Are Real. There's the Phoenix Memo in the FBI, the one talking about flying planes, terrorists attending civil aviation schools and not wanting to land those planes. Another intelligence report entitled, Bin Laden Attacks May Be Imminent, Bin Laden Associates Making Near-Term Threats. Clark's warning, quote, when these attacks occur, as they likely will wonder what more we could have done to stop them. Threat advisories in June 2001 saying that the terrorist attacks are likely to be spectacular. That's not my words, that's their words. And that Al-Qaeda's activity was reaching a crescendo. We have Clark warning Rice again at least twice about Al-Qaeda's sleeper cells in the United States. And of course the memo that CIA Director George Tenet got in August 2001, the memo from Colleen Rowley entitled, quote, Islamic Extremist Learns to Fly, unquote. In that memo, on August 23rd, this is directly out of the pages of the report. If you read nothing else, read page 275 of the report. It says, quote, on August 23rd, Director Tenet was briefed about the Mousawi case in a briefing titled Islamic Extremist Learns to Fly. Tenet was told Mousawi wanted to learn to fly a 747, paid for his training in cash, was interested to learn the doors do not open in flight, and wanted to fly a simulated flight from London to New York. He was told the FBI arrested Mousawi, and he was told about his presence in the United States. Now, all these things led Tenet to the conclusion on September 11th, according to Woodward's book, that in fact Mousawi's plan of flying the planes was actually behind it. So we have all kinds of examples of the negligence of Bush officials. Now, am I saying that the officials wanted September 11th to occur? No, I'm not making those kinds of conspiracy theories. I do think, though, that we have an incompetent administration. And I think that this should be made clear. People should know the truth. And again, I think the only way to fix this thing is to have an independent commission. Now, to read from the blog, Rick says from New York City, I don't see any way these appointees, subcommittees, and their chairs can be properly insulated from politics. Just look at the treatment wizened people like Richard Clark, Paul O'Neill, and Joe Wilson received when the parties involved felt politically vulnerable. Nothing less than character assassination was the order of the day. I also feel a bit confused as to the need for a terrorism czar. Was this a deliberated and studied plan or simply a swipe at Condi Rice? Also, I see the post being filled by another silly mouthpiece like Tom Ridge. The idea of another bureaucrat on top of a new layer of bureaucracy doesn't bode well for the sharing of information, nor a united front against terrorism. Well, Rick, I think you say a lot of good things. I think you say a lot of very clear things. It's true that Richard Clark, former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, former Ambassador Joe Wilson, when they tried to talk against the administration, received a lot of flack. I do think, though, there are still independent entities in government that, while not completely politically isolated, do work. The Fed is one example. The scientific commissions before they were changed by George Bush is another example. There are all kinds. There's actually the Congressional Budget Office is another example. These are institutions that try to be bipartisan, that try to get it right. I think it is possible, but again, I think you're right, Rick, to really go back, excuse me, Rod, this is Rod's comment, to go back to what I said, NSA Director William Odom said, and that is, if you've got the wrong kind of leadership, you're just not going to get the right kind of intelligence. I mean, look at the fact that we set up the entire Homeland Security Department to protect us against these threats. And what does the Bush administration do from day one? They start to undermine it and to develop this separate off-the-shelf group called the Terrorist Threat Information Center. So that's it for my time. I think hope we got a decent amount of coverage. Obviously, there's 500-something pages in the 9/11 Commission report. I haven't read it all, but I did want to give you the inside scoop on what I read so that you can respond. If anyone says, oh, Clinton didn't do anything or Bush has done everything, you got to know the facts. I don't know the 9/11 Commission solution is the proper solution, but I think they did get their facts straight. And if you know nothing else from this program, just remember that 9/11 was not caused by Iraq, but instead Al-Qaeda had collaborative relationships with a whole bunch of other countries. I'll read that list off one more time. Egypt, Algeria, Yemen, Lebanon, Morocco, Tunisia, Somalia, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, Pakistan. All of them had connections with Al-Qaeda. None of them we invaded. So that's a good list to tell your friends. Tomorrow's Election Tuesday. I debate Tom Robbins again. We're going to talk about the Democratic National Convention. You're going to hear my favorite replays of the Kerry speech, different from what you've heard before. And you'll hear Tom Robbins try as much as he can to...